From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The games are on in Vancouver. Ahead on Only a Game, a preview of the 21st Winter Olympics with John Powers. Also, a look at how these games will benefit Canada or not. An audio tour of some of Vancouver's hottest and coldest venues, and if that is just too much slipping and sliding for you, I'll also talk with the author of a new biography of Willie Mays. Also, the president of Burundi turns to sports to help heal the divisions caused by a brutal civil war.
It's good to have a fun president, but someone who actually does work would also be good for us. Create jobs, sort out the political mess, free political prisoners. There's a lot to do.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Winter Games in Vancouver began as scheduled last night with pageantry, but a fatal accident preceded the opening ceremonies. Yesterday afternoon, Georgian Nodar Kumartashvili crashed on the luge run, sailed off the course, and slammed into a steel pole. He was given emergency resuscitation at the Whistler Sliding Center and rushed to a hospital in Vancouver, where he was pronounced dead. Even before the fatal accident, there had been lesser mishaps, and competitors had raised questions about the safety of the luge course. Joining me now from Vancouver to comment further on the Winter Games is veteran Olympics writer John Powers of the Boston Globe. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Morning, Bill.
Yesterday, the practice runs were suspended after the accident. The men's luge competition is scheduled to begin today to proceed on schedule. How was that decision reached?
Well, what they did was the International Luge Federation officials looked at the video, and they basically decided that it wasn't a problem with the track. It was basically a reasonably inexperienced luger who made a mistake. He went into a curve wrong, came out of it wrong, couldn't make the adjustment. Even then, it was an absolute shock. I mean, I've never seen anybody go out of the run entirely, and that's what happened here. And in the press room, when they showed the clips, people were just, wow, what happened there? And everyone knew that it was bad. Everyone knew. But I think what they are going to do, they'll make a small adjustment to the ice down there, and also put a little bit higher wall to make sure it doesn't keep happening. But they will go ahead and schedule. And of course, one thing here, this run is used for three sliding sports, not just one. This is also the bobsled and the skeleton.
You attended last night's opening ceremonies at BC Place Stadium. How were those ceremonies altered to acknowledge the death of an athlete just hours before they began?
Well, it was interesting. It's unclear whether everyone knew the news, but right at the very beginning, there was a huge sign that said that the opening ceremonies were dedicated to his memory. Jacques Rogge asked for a moment of silence. The flags were lowered to half-mast. That's never happened at the Olympic Games before. And Jacques Rogge gave a press conference earlier in the day and was fighting back tears. Clearly, it was a shock to everybody. And I think no one quite knew how to handle it in terms of the ceremony, which is always a big, a joy. Everyone's happy. And it definitely cast a pall. But it was also interesting, the Georgian team wasn't quite sure what to do. And they elected to not only go to the ceremonies, but to compete in the games. And they got a standing ovation when they came into the stadium.
John, the games will go on, and when they do, many eyes in the U.S. will be on top American downhiller Lindsey Vonn, who's been dealing with a shin injury. What's the latest on her status?
Well, she had, earlier on, she had not been taking painkillers, and she was in a lot of discomfort. Even putting a boot on was a problem. Every day, the leg seems to get better. She is taking some medication now. She did do a run and was able to get through it. And the question is, I think she feels it's a matter of just gritting my teeth and getting through this thing. She has had an advantage basically because there have been some runs postponed. If the weather doesn't get better up at Whistler, they may have to postpone the Super Combines a day or two. That wouldn't hurt her because her competitors also have not been able to get runs in either. I don't think she'd mind two or three more days of this.
Will there be sufficient snow for Vonn et al. To shush and slide on?
Well, they have a ton of snow up at Whistler. I think mostly what the issue the other day was, it's gotten unusually warm. So they've got fog, it's wet, and I think there's a sense of visibility issues. They'll definitely go if it's a little bit wet or slushy. And they've actually got the same problem down below at Cypress Mountain, which is almost at sea level, with basically just wet conditions. So we'll know a little more today. The men's downhill is supposed to go. There was talk that it might not go, at least not today. The freestyle moguls for the women, which is tonight, that's Canada's best chance at a gold medal right off the bat. They've got the defending champion, Jennifer Heil. They would like to get this thing off, but if they have a visibility issue, that'll definitely be a problem up at Whistler.
The USA comes into these games perhaps less strong in figure skating, stronger in some other areas. What other nations would be considered as favorites in terms of potential medal hauls?
Well, I think one of the biggest issues here is the bold statement by Canada. They want to own the podium. I mean, this is as a matter of fact, the joke is that if the Americans wanted to own the podium, they'd buy it with a subprime mortgage and no money down. But this is a country, the only country that hosts both the Winter and Summer Games and not win a gold medal is Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they certainly will do much, much better. They won, I think, 7 gold medals in Turin. It's just a matter of when. Certainly Germany, which has been the country to beat the last several years, will still be number one. Russia will be okay, but it'll be those top four. The U.S., I think, basically is hoping that they can do as well as it did in Turin, maybe 25 medals, a little more than that. But it is unusual to not have a top woman in figure skating. That hasn't happened since 1964.
John, as a veteran of Olympics coverage, which events will you be paying special attention to?
Well, I think the one that has everybody's fascination is Nordic combined. The Americans have never won a medal at the Olympics, but they came in with two world champions in Todd Lodwick and Billy DeMong, plus a former world champion in Johnny Spillane. They've got three chances to be able to get at least a medal there. So people are just fascinated. This is an area where the U.S. has never shown much strength until recently. The biathlon also is a possibility. The U.S. has never medaled there, but Tim Burke has a decent chance in at least two events.
John Powers has been our news hound of the Halo since 1994. John, thanks once again.
Thank you, Bill.
More than 3 billion people around the globe will tune in to watch the Vancouver Winter Olympics. Thousands will be in Canada's third largest city to experience the Games in person. In the days leading up to the Winter Games, reporter Sadie Babbitts captured some of the sights and sounds of Vancouver and neighboring Whistler.
The next train to arrive on the inbound platform is for Waterfront.
It's 7 in the morning, and one of Vancouver's newest attractions is packed. Okay, the Canada Line is more of a necessity than an attraction. This new light rail system was built just for the Olympics, and it's been busy since it opened in December. It's the best way to get around because here in Vancouver, having a car is more trouble than it's worth. Roads get closed temporarily for Olympic festivities like the torch relay and the opening ceremonies. There are short detours around the road closures, and forget about finding a parking space. The train runs to Vancouver's waterfront. Seaplanes take off from Vancouver Harbor, right over barges and freighters heading toward the mountains. The Olympic rings are perched, like seagulls on buoys, out in the middle of the harbor. At night, the rings cast a rainbow of colors across dark water. The oldest part of Vancouver is just a few blocks away. This is Gastown. The cobblestone sidewalks pass by trendy bars and souvenir shops stocked with Olympic memorabilia. But most everyone comes to stand on this one street corner to hear the Gastown steam clock.
Westminster Chalk. Wow. Wow, that was
great.
Is
that it?
Wasn't that come to Vancouver and hear the steam clock?
No, it's on the half hour, it'll do more.
Oh.
Quarter two, it'll do three lots.
That's Mavis Forshaw. She just flew in from Sydney, Australia with her daughter.
I was here to see a friend about 8 years ago, and she brought me down here. So I wanted to relive that memory because she's recently died. So I've come to relive some memories and also come to the Olympic Games.
Steam rises from the top of the clock as the hands reach 4 o'clock. It turns out this antique timepiece actually runs on electricity. It used to be powered by steam, but locals say the pipes corroded. Everyone's trading pins and trying to buy red mittens with the Canadian maple leaf on each palm. Karen Euler is buying mittens for her friends and neighbor kids back home.
These obviously are a good price.
How much are they?
$10. And they seem to be the roots cap of the Games of Salt Lake and then in Torino. These seem to be the hot item right now.
Hot indeed. Already 2 million have sold here at the Olympic Superstore in downtown Vancouver. The last shipment of 1 million just came in. 2 hours north of Vancouver, it's snowing in Whistler and it's frigid. The crowds aren't bad yet. In fact, on Blackcomb Mountain, one of the main ski venues here, there's hardly anybody on the slopes. The Blackcomb gondola going up the mountain is empty, and there are only a few snowboarders and skiers zigzagging down the slopes. 50 years ago, a group of businessmen watching the Winter Games on TV got the crazy idea that Whistler should make a bid for the Games. They did, twice. Whistler resident John Richmond says they lost both times.
Where we're standing right now used to be the garbage dump.
You're kidding, right?
Yep, there's a garbage dump here. But to make the bid more credible, they named a run coming off Whistler Mountain into the garbage dump as the Olympic Run. It still exists today, and it's still the most popular run to ski into the village.
Now Whistler has a sliding center for bobsleigh, luge, and skeleton. There's Whistler Creekside, a venue for alpine skiing, and Olympic Park will host everything from biathlon to ski jumping. A crowd gathers around the Olympic ticketing office. You can't see much. Everything's blocked off. But behind the screens, a dress rehearsal is underway. Yes, that's the sound of a practice medal ceremony here in the heart of Whistler. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
To see Sadie Babbitts' photo gallery from Vancouver, please visit onlyagame.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Olympic medalists for the cross-country
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It's obvious that people electing to walk rather than ride in taxis will save money and burn calories. Now, folks in Japan can calculate exactly how much money they're saving and precisely how many calories they're burning when they make that choice. A gimmick called Taxi Walker measures the distance its wearer walks and registers how much the fare would have been if the walker had taken a cab instead, while also calculating energy expended. The gizmo is available in various colors, but according to Keiko Sakaba, who is in charge of marketing the Taxi Walker, the most popular model is painted in yellow with a checkerboard trim, just like a typical Tokyo cab.
I'm walking, yes indeed, I'm talking. I'm hoping that you come back to me. I'm lonely as I can be, and I've waited for your company, and I'm hoping.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, yet another opportunity for me to celebrate baseball's greatest player, Willie Mays. But first, while lots of Canadians are excited that Vancouver is hosting the current Winter Olympics, it's fair to say that some of those Canadians are also anxious. Or at least it's fair to say that, according to Dr. Robert Thacker, and he should know because he is a professor of Canadian Studies at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. Professor Thacker attributes the anxiety to Canada's history as an Olympics host.
One of the things Canadians are very, very concerned about with this Olympics is that they are the only host country which has not won a gold ever at its own Olympics. So there's a push in all the winter sports. I heard a report the other night on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation where they had an athlete who said, it will happen, and it will happen early in the games. And
the pressure's on.
Yeah, there is. And I very much actually, I'm sympathetic to Canada. I very much hope it does, just so that it's happened.
Apparently, you don't have to be a professor of Canadian studies to feel that way. You can also be Canadian Olympics official and former speed skating medalist Natalie Lambert.
And I don't care where the medals are coming from. Honestly, you know, if we don't have medals in curling, but we have more medals in alpine skiing than we thought, then it evens out. I just want happy faces and proud faces at the end of the game.
Proud and happy Canadian faces at the end of these games would be good, and even better, at least from the standpoint of the Canadian Olympic Committee, would be lots of ink that's black rather than red. In that respect, according to Professor Thacker, Canada's current record is 1-1.
The Canadians had the Winter Games once before in 1988 in Calgary, and they were quite successful. The 1976 Summer Games are infamous, actually, because the then mayor of Montreal, a man named Drapeau, said that it would be as likely that those games would lose money as it would be for a man to have a baby.
Though there is no record of Mr. Drapeau giving birth, the debt incurred by Montreal for the 76 games was finally paid off about an hour and 20 minutes ago, an embarrassment that troubles Natalie Lambert not at all.
I do believe that games in a country, no matter how much, how high is the bill for the infrastructures, it's a platform, you know, for 17 days to have the whole world look at your city, your province, your country. There's nothing that compares to that.
Nothing that compares, especially if, while the whole world is watching, Canada can come out on top in the sports that have always mattered most to Canadians, ice hockey and curling. According to Mike Chambers, the president of the Canadian Olympic Committee, the explanation for their affection is simple.
We're born with skates on our feet and brooms in our hand. We're either going to grow up to be hockey players or curlers.
The tournaments that will determine which teams will medal in women's and men's ice hockey will begin today and Tuesday. Curling will also commence on Tuesday. So, Mr. Chambers, what if Canada reaps no gold in either sport?
That's a hypothetical question. I never answer hypothetical questions.
Were there tears in his eyes when Mr. Chambers was asked to entertain that disturbing possibility? Well, yes, there were. But maybe it was just the chilly wind. To learn more about the books we feature or the music you hear on Only a Game, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. All right, first, partial disclosure. As far as I'm concerned, nobody ever played baseball better than Willie Mays did. This means that I was a happy and hungry reader for Jim Hirsch's new book, Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. And now for the rest of the disclosure, I'm in the book. That's because I told Jim Hirsch that when I was a little kid, I dressed up as Willie Mays for Halloween. And that story is on page 231. Now that I've gotten that out of the way, I can say to Jim Hirsch, who joins me in the studio, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be here.
Willie Mays first began playing in the New York Giants minor league system in June 1950. He had just turned 19 at the time. Tell us the story about how his teammates there took care of him on the night following his first game, which was played in Hagerstown, Maryland.
Well, keep in mind that Willie was born and raised in Alabama and had been surrounded by most of his life by fellow African Americans. Now he is signed by the New York Giants and sent to their minor league team in Trenton, and suddenly he is the only black person on the team, the only black person in the entire league. And so his first night with the team, the bus, drops Willie off at the Negro Hotel and takes the rest of the players to their hotel. Around midnight, Willie hears a knock on the window, and three of his teammates have come by, and they open up the window, and they come in, and they tell Willie that, hey, we're going to stay with you. And the three of them slept on the floor that night, and then early in the morning, they got up and left and rejoined their teammates. And what was important with that story for Willie is that it reminded him that his baseball team and his teammates were not just his colleagues, they were his family. And all his life, Willie associated baseball and his teammates with his family.
I guess the best known daddy in that family was Leo Durocher, who, of course, was managing the Giants when Willie first came up to the big team.
And Leo recognized Willie's talents even when Willie was in the minor leagues, and he wanted Willie up with the team as soon as possible. Leo played a tremendously important role for Willie as his father figure, because when Willie got to New York at age 20, you know, the big city, he was petrified, and he needed someone who would constantly reassure him and encourage him and build his confidence. Willie got off to a terrible start. He was like 0 for 12, and he was ready to be sent back down to the minor leagues. For that matter, Willie thought he should go back to the Negro Leagues. But Leo reassured him and said, as long as I'm the manager, you're going to be my center fielder.
Willie Mays was starring in center field with the Giants when Mickey Mantle was starring in center field with the Yankees and Duke Snider was starring in center field with the Dodgers. Those three teams were within a subway ride of one another in New York and Brooklyn. To what extent did that work to benefit Mays?
Well, it was really the golden era of baseball, New York City in the 1950s. And the competition among the three was great for the media. It was a time when television was just coming into being. We had new magazines coming out, and they needed a storyline. And so the story of who was the best, Willie, Mickey, or the Duke, provided this kind of running argument, a running conversation among all the boroughs of New York, and it just served to raise baseball's profile even further.
It was more than a running conversation, and it extended well beyond the boroughs of New York. Because in northern New Jersey, it sometimes took the effect of fistfights between 10-year-old boys.
They took that argument very seriously, yourself included.
Jim, ask most people to identify the greatest catch Willie Mays ever made, and they will cite his over-the-shoulder grab of the line drive Cleveland's Vic Wertz hit in the 1954 World Series. But you suggest, in fact, that Willie's greatest catch may have come in his second season with the Giants, 1952, in a game at Ebbets Field. Tell us about that catch.
Well, Willie was playing deep, and there was a drive hit into the left center field alley all the way to the wall. And Willie raced back for it and dove and hit the wall and the ground. And about the same time, his elbow struck him right in the gut. He hung on to the ball, but the crash of his body against both the wall and the ground was so violent that he nearly knocked himself out. His teammates, the manager, the trainer, all came running out. And ultimately, Jackie Robinson came out as well to see if he was okay, although Durocher later told him that really Robinson came out just to see if he caught the ball.
To make sure he'd held the ball.
Absolutely.
Did Willie Mays lead you to the conclusion that that was, in fact, his greatest catch?
The funny thing about Willie is that he doesn't really talk in those terms. He's really a very modest person. He'll not really brag about specific plays or even his career. And when you ask him what was his greatest this or that, he says, well, you have to ask other people. That's not for me to say.
A little less than halfway through the book, you write that Willie Mays had become, and I'm quoting now, the new archetype of the star ball player, a category unto himself. How so?
Up until that time, players tended to fall into two categories. There was the classic small ball hitter who was fast, used a lot of speed, finesse, and hit for high average. Ty Cobb was the prototype of that player. And then there was the classic slugger who hit home runs. And, of course, Babe Ruth was the prototype for that. Willie Mays came along, and he was an anomaly because he could both hit for high average, steal bases, and hit home runs. We had never seen that up until that time. Now, of course, Leo Durocher called him the first five-tool player, again, a phrase that hadn't been used until Willie came along. So he became this new archetype who could excel in all parts of the game.
A lot of the writers who celebrated Mays at his best characterized him as a natural, and certainly his gifts were many and grand, but you make the point several times that he was also an extremely intelligent ball player. Was that something sports writers in the 50s and 60s just weren't inclined to acknowledge?
They were not inclined to acknowledge, and race is part of the explanation here. Willie and other black players of that era were often patronized. Great natural skills, but not given much credit for their intelligence, their preparation, their guile. And Willie resented that in some ways because they always said, well, he has great instincts. But in fact, Willie was a great student of the game. He would study pitchers, study their moves to first base. He would study the arms of opposing outfielders. He would stay on the field extra long just to get a mental data book of all these players. But Willie was rarely given credit for that.
Jim, whereas Jackie Robinson has long been celebrated for what he accomplished on behalf of African Americans within baseball and beyond, Willie Mays has sometimes been regarded as too quiet on race and racism. Is that a legitimate charge?
I don't think it's a legitimate charge because I think Willie made a huge contribution to civil rights. He was never comfortable speaking out on the issue. He did not feel qualified. He was self-conscious of the way he spoke, his diction, his grammar. And so he never wanted to take the lead, but he believed that as a role model, the way he played baseball on the field would show people of all backgrounds, all races, what black people were capable of. And I think the record shows that, in fact, he did have a huge influence on showing whites not just that blacks were great players, but just they were men of character and integrity. I spoke to Bill Clinton for the book, and Clinton talks about growing up in the segregated South in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And he was surrounded by segregationists, but on Saturday, they would stay home and watch Willie Mays play on the game of the week. And as Clinton said, even on a subconscious level, that had a huge impact because Willie made a mockery of all forms of bigotry.
You write about, and I'm quoting again here, the burden of being Willie Mays. What did you have in mind with that phrase?
Willie put tremendous pressure on himself to excel. And he got overly tired repeatedly. He pushed himself to his physical and emotional limits. Because he pushed himself so much, because he got exhausted, he was frequently hospitalized. And there was all type of speculation if he had medical issues. But the reality was he just needed to get away and find that privacy so he could come back and be Willie Mays.
Willie Mays in his 20s and into his 30s and even his late 30s may well have been the very best player in Major League Baseball of his time. He kept playing into his 40s. You write that he kept playing in part, quote, because it was all he had ever done and all he really knew. Lots of people who saw his last seasons with the Mets certainly feel that he played too long. Was he afraid of retirement?
Willie Mays was an entertainer who had no second act. But I think in some ways, the memories we have of Willie in that last game in the World Series where he made those misplays in the outfield against Oakland, they've really cheated his legacy because, yes, Willie Mays played too long, but so did a lot of great athletes. You know, Ruth played too long. Aaron, Mantle, Gibson, and in other sports, Unitas, Ali, Gretzky, Jordan. It's very difficult for these guys to walk away from the glory.
I'm speaking with Jim Hirsch, the author of a new biography of Willie Mays, and you're listening to Only a Game. Willie Mays has stood by Barry Bonds recently. Of course, Bonds' father, Bobby, was a close friend of Willie Mays. To what extent has that tarnished his reputation, especially among fans too young to have seen Mays himself play?
I don't think it tarnishes his reputation as long as people understand who Willie Mays is. Of course, Willie is the godfather of Barry Bonds. But the thing about Willie is that he will stand next to every baseball player. You will never hear Willie say anything critical about McGuire or A-Rod. That's because to Willie, these are his family members. So he's always going to stand behind them. And I think there's something rather noble in saying that I'm going to show that respect to the game and those who played it by always standing with fellow players.
A lot of writers over the years have characterized Willie Mays as a bitter guy in his old age, a man unwilling to grant interviews unless he's paid to do it. Does he strike you as an unhappy man?
No. Willie certainly has a gruff exterior, and he doesn't trust people. He's felt that he's been betrayed many times. He's been taken advantage of financially, all of which is true. He's also been the object of racial discrimination throughout his life. He won't talk about it, but it's there. And he does keep outsiders at arm's length. However, Willie is very mindful of the trajectory of his life, that he began as this poor Depression-era black kid in the Deep South, and now he can go anywhere and be treated like royalty, including Air Force One flying with the president. As Willie said to me, I could not have dreamt the life that I've lived. He's very satisfied with that life, and he believes that he's a role model for children. I think that's one of the reasons he cooperated with this book. He wanted that life story told.
James Hirsch is the author of Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, published by Scribner. Jim, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure, Bill.
When Willie served his Uncle Sam, he left the Giants in an awful jam. But now he's back, and he's Leo's joy, and Willie's still a growing boy. Say hey,
say who?
Say Willie, say hey,
say who?
Swinging at the plate, say hey,
say who?
Say Willie, that Giants kid is great. That Giants kid is great. Say Willie, what you gonna say?
Say hey.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Burundi's soccer-playing chief executive inspires a fitness craze among his constituents. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Olympic flame has been lit in Vancouver. What events or athletes are likely to grab your attention over the next 16 days?
Well, I've been following America's own Johnny Weir and his Sundance Channel docudrama, Be Good, Johnny Weir. So that's one for sure. I'm certainly going to follow the curlers because I always follow the curlers.
Absolutely.
Actually, Johnny Weir probably follows the curlers too, but that's neither here nor there. I think for sure I'm going to follow the snowboarders again because if only for the post-competition interviews because they all talk in King Crimson lyrics.
Okay. The NBA's All-Star Game takes to Cowboys Stadium on Sunday without would-be starters Kobe Bryant and Allen Iverson. Forget about that Kobe guy. How will the East fare without the help of the answer?
Well, I think that, you know, David Lee from the Knicks, who's having a terrific season, is taking his place, and that's a good thing. You know, Iverson was a fluke of the ballot. It was purely a popularity contest to put him in there. Kobe has a bad foot. That's why he's not playing, which makes it very bizarre that Paul Pierce from the Celtics is playing. In any event, I'm very happy for David Lee, who deserves to be there.
92,000 fans are expected to fill the seats and the standing room only decks at Cowboy Stadium on Sunday. That's more people than have attended the last five All-Star games combined, which is good unless you happen to make your living reselling tickets.
That's right, because the capacity has helped drive the ticket brokers, scalpers, prices down. The average price for the game is $186 on one site. And in the previous 5 years, the averages range from 508 to 2,546 in Las Vegas. So, having them in football stadiums, which is a terrible place to watch basketball in any context, is actually a bargain if you don't mind not seeing the game. It's cheaper not to see the game in the building than it is to see the game in the building.
On the other end of the attendance spectrum, the New Jersey Nets lost another basketball game on Wednesday night. Nets officials blamed bad weather for the fact that only 1,016 people showed up for that beauty. Good excuse?
Well, at least part of a good excuse. They might have gotten the attendance all the way up to 3,500 if it had been sunny and 38 degrees. It is, in fact, a shame that we are a radio show and not a TV show, because I can't hold up this photo, this panoramic photo of the arena during the Nets game, which I think you pointed out before the show, made the whole place look like a peewee hockey matchup at 6 o'clock in the morning in the suburbs.
I remember that venue. I skated there. Rick Pitino, the head coach of the men's basketball team at Louisville, said this week that he has no interest at all, period, in coaching the New Jersey Nets. So when does he move to Piscataway?
I don't think he's going to. I think basically he really does want to stay where he is. And let's face facts. Over the last couple of years, he's had more people chasing him with subpoenas than were at that Nets game the other night.
Charlie, since we last spoke, the Saints won the Super Bowl. You don't suppose New Orleans... You've answered the question already. I was going to say, you don't suppose New Orleans celebrated with a parade?
Well, I think this is the first 10 or 11 day Mardi Gras they've ever had. I mean, Mardi Gras didn't happen until Tuesday.
I gather the doings in Indianapolis were, a little more subdued.
11 people showed up to greet the team at the airport. And oddly enough, Bill, one of them was wearing a Saints jersey and Peyton Manning threw him a football.
Have you been planning that?
Oh, no. I'm just...
You just came up with
I'm
that.
I'm just saying. That's all.
Extraordinary. Sunday's game set a record. No televised event has ever enjoyed more viewers. So is that Alan Alda I hear shouting, we're number two, number two?
I am so glad that episode of MASH is no longer the number one rated television program in the history of television. It was so awful. But I think it is an indication of how utterly charmed the nation was with the whole story from New Orleans. And I think... You know, I think that's a very good thing.
NASCAR's first race of the season is Sunday's Daytona 500, when Jimmy Johnson, Dale Earnhardt Jr., Michael Waltrip, among others, will take to the starting line. But, as I understand it, most of the buzz is about Saturday's lower-level nationwide series race. So, Mr. NASCAR, please explain.
Danica Patrick will be driving in her stock car debut in the nationwide series on Saturdays as a part-time driver, because she's going to continue to run the full IndyCar schedule. I predict that long about the fourth or fifth race of the NASCAR season, this is going to get really old on the drivers, and you're going to see some very unflattering comments about Ms. Patrick start filtering into the press.
The American entry BMW Oracle won the first race of the 33rd.
Wait a minute. The America's Cup?
The America's Cup.
Wow.
It's on.
I remember that.
Great big boats.
Multi-hulled. Yes, go ahead, anyway.
Anyway, the America's Cup first race actually happened, and BMW Oracle won it. So will you be watching when the two teams meet for the second and possibly final time on Sunday?
Well, I'm not exactly sure because, quite frankly, I didn't know this was going on until the other day.
That's why I'm here.
When it used to be a big deal down in Newport, now apparently we could probably race. We could take the Constitution out of dry dock in Charlestown and race it.
This week marks the passing of 90-year-old Walter Frederick Morrison, best known as the guy who invented the Frisbee. Since Morrison began manufacturing his, quote, Pluto platters in 1948, more than 200 million of them have been sold. Not a bad legacy to leave behind 200 million happy people playing in the park with your invention.
And
huh?
16 million of them sitting up on roofs never to come down.
Some on mine. Charlie, before you start shouting sports, I'm going to point out that the following accomplishment required 15 years of training and that it definitely should not be tried at home under any circumstances. Ooh. Given those two caveats, would you like to offer a nod to Mr. Cheney Holtgren, a.k.a. the Space Cowboy?
Only some people call him that. Some people call him the Gangster of Love and other people call him Maurice. But in any event, he is the world champion sword swallower. And he swallowed, not entirely, by the way, because if you see from the photo, they just sort of stick out of his mouth, 18 swords,
18.
Which is a record. I was most fascinated by how you train. Apparently, you train to be a world-class sword swallower by learning to swallow a garden hose in your youth. And that's as far as I'm going to go because there are too many jokes that suggested them, and all of them will cost our license.
Over. Stops here. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he's not even swallowed one sword for us here at Only a Game, but it's got to happen someday soon. Thanks, Charlie.
Sometimes, Bill, a joke is merely a gag.
Last week's Super Bowl haiku delighted Laura Bentley, who hears only a game on KPSD in San Diego. "I must be one sick pup," she wrote. "I live for Super Bowl haiku. I mark my calendar to ensure that I hear it. Thank you again for a wonderful annual celebration." Among those submitting haiku right up until kickoff time and beyond was Carmela Martell, a WBUR listener and author of this irreverent and nostalgic little number, Super Bowl Nonsense, Call Me for Commercials of Budweiser Horses. Among the cyber responses generated by Super Bowl Haiku XVI was this skeptical musing from David Fly. "Super Bowl football returns to disturb my life. I still don't get it." Mr. Fly flooded our website with more than a dozen haiku, some of which we may trot out next February. Last week, Charlie Pierce and I commented on the ongoing success of the women's basketball team at the University of Connecticut, which irked at least a couple of listeners in Nebraska. "You need to realize the country does not revolve around New England," wrote John Chiocchi, who hears the program on KUCV in Lincoln. "The Nebraska Lady Huskers are 21-0. Richard Graham, who also lives in Nebraska and listens on the Internet, was similarly dismayed. "Why no love for the University of Nebraska's meteoric rise?" he asked. John and Richard, I hope you'll both be listening on March 20th, when we will have a story about that very team. Last week's program also featured my conversation with Dr. Gay Culverhouse, the former president of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Dr. Culverhouse heads a foundation devoted to locating and helping veterans of the National Football League who were suffering from dementia and various other work-related disabilities. This moved Alan Bedford of Greenville, South Carolina, to leave the following message on our Facebook page. "We've been hearing for years about how the NFL and Players Association have ignored players' suffering. Now here's an NFL insider doing something about it. Great work and an excellent interview." You too can contact us at facebook.com/onlyagameradio. You can follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. And, of course, you can always reach us directly through the website onlyagame.org. Over 200 U.S. athletes will compete in the Vancouver Games. The East African country of Burundi has sent zero. Burundi may be more well-known for its civil war than for its international athletes, but on a Sunday morning in the capital of Bujumbura, you wouldn't know that. Its soccer fields are a rainbow of brightly uniformed teams, and its streets are lined with leggy runners. Angeli Nair reports from Bujumbura on Burundi's exercise fever.
On a Sunday morning walk in the hills of Gatoke, the diplomatic neighborhood overlooking the city, I am overtaken by a mob of enthusiastic runners. I break into a jog to catch up. The group's name is Abafata Namunda, or Those Who Support One Another, and they do a loop of the city every Sunday. It takes several hours. I ask why everyone in Burundi is so, well, sporty. A runner named Mutima tells me Sunday is the day for sports. Even the president plays sports on Sunday. True to his reputation that weekend late last year, the president, Pierre Nkurunziza, was playing sports. He was in Gitega, about 50 kilometers east of Bujumbura, playing with his soccer team, Hallelujah FC, a fitting name considering the president is a born-again Christian. The sight of His Excellency, a 46-year-old burly goal scorer, tearing down the soccer field at high speed, has become a common spectacle around the country. President Nkurunziza plays three times a week. In Gitega, locals crowd around the field hoping for a glimpse of the president. They've become his personal cheering squad, celebrating every time he handles the ball. The president's team wins 3-0, but he says sports aren't just about the score.
Sports helps build friendships, and sports brings people together. It's very important because after that you can develop socially, as you have better communication.
Who better to coach the people of Burundi into a healthy and active lifestyle than a former coach and teacher? President Nkurunziza started his career teaching physical education and coaching soccer before ethnic clashes in Bujumbura in the 1990s forced him to flee. Relations between the ethnic Hutu majority and the Tutsi minority had been tense throughout the region since independence from Belgium in the 1960s. But the relations degenerated further in the 1990s, leading to a civil war that killed at least 300,000 people in Burundi, around 800,000 in Rwanda, and millions more in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo continues to this day. During the war, President Nkurunziza was the leader of a Hutu rebel movement called CNDD, or Forces for the Defense of Democracy. And after a truce between factions in 2005, he became the country's president. In the narrow lanes of Bujumbura's central market, people are wary of speaking out against their footballing president. But away from the crowds, I get the real story from two shoppers.
I don't have anything against football, but, you know, your president, you have something more important to do than football. That's the reason why they voted for him. They didn't want a football player. In his policies, it wasn't about football, it was about leading the country.
Yeah, well, one thing that bothers me sometimes is that, you know, we'd like our country to be respected. It's good to have a fun president, but someone who actually does work would also be really good for us. You know, create jobs, find resources for the country, sort out the political mess, free political prisoners. There's a lot to do.
People here do admit, if nothing else, that President Nkurunziza, through his life of leisure, has managed to lighten the mood in Burundi. The president bikes the streets his predecessors drove in armored cars, and this relaxed atmosphere is helping lessen ethnic tensions.
Et puis le football, c'est un jeu complet.
Soccer is a complete game because you use all parts of the body, the arms, the legs, the spirit, the heart, the brain. After the war, soccer has helped in reinforcing ties, friendship, and a spirit of tolerance.
L'esprit, le cœur, le cerveau, tout.
That's Colonel Augustin Nibaruta. He's tall, slim, and composed. I meet up with his soccer team, FC Tempête, at their clubhouse near Lake Tanganyika in the capital. On the 5th of February, the country's Unity Day, the Tempête hosted a reconciliation match between Hutus and Tutsis.
I am Hutu, and that guy over there is Tutsi. We play soccer together to show people that we are the same and that we can live together in harmony.
The important thing is not to win, but to participate. That guy, he's my friend. He's more than my friend.
The message is being passed on to Burundi's next generation, too. Next to the Tempête's grounds, around 40 young boys between the ages of 8 and 12 are practicing one-touch passes in oversized green Puma uniforms. Their coach is Jean-Jacques Ndadishimije, or Mulume for short. He's a former player for one of the country's best teams, FC Vitalo. Mulume told me his boys train twice a week and four times a week when school's out. Their goal is to play in Burundi's professional league, or even better, in Europe. But does training together really help repair the past, I ask? Mulume says that when the boys play here, tribal issues are left behind. Tutsis, Hutus, and even other communities play together. He doesn't see issues between the boys like he used to. Now, there is peace. Despite President Nkurunziza's best efforts to bring together the country through sport, there is a long way to go before there is real and lasting peace in Burundi. And it will be a difficult goal until Burundi's neighbors, Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, solve the ethnic issues within their borders, on or off the field. For Only a Game, I'm Anjali Nair. Yeah.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Joel Hurd at North Country Public Radio, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, learn more about our weekly music selections, or view our photo galleries, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from one of those cute, cuddly little Vancouver mascots. Whoa, I guess he's still a little angry that the IOC even considered South Korea and Austria as hosts for the 2010 Games. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.